Evening Post, Spirit of 1932 lives on to this day. At least that's the headline in the Evening Post. It's not called the Evening Post anymore, it's called The Post. Maybe I can ask you, Tim, if you've seen the new edition of the local paper, and what do you think?
I think I may have done, yeah. It's I haven't looked through it, I had a brief look today and then just caught my eye that it perhaps changed. Yeah, I mean, perhaps it's a reinvention, a redefining of itself, trying to attract new readers, you know, by giving itself a new name. I hope it works for them, if that's what they're trying to do.
It's slightly embarrassing timing in the last end of last week they just announced another 20 redundancies.
Yes, I've heard they've announced journalist redundancies, as you say, of about 20. I'm not privy to those details, of course, but difficult times for businesses. I guess it could be perhaps a victim of the recession.
Martin, there was also a protest on Tuesday outside the Evening Post's birthday exhibition in the galleries. Are you surprised that the Evening Post themselves didn't report it?
No, not really. I mean, that's why Al Jazeera doesn't report what's going on in Bahrain, because they're in cahoots with the Bahraini royal family.
OK, well, let's go down to 6:30, roughly, on Tuesday, go down to the galleries to hear a little report from the protest that I did.
The Post was founded in 1932 by the Bristol community in defiance at Northcliffe's attempt to win a Bristol monopoly for its title, The Bristol World. 6 years ago, there were close to 190 journalists on the Post, Western Daily Press and Observer. After this call, there'll be fewer than 40.
My name is Susie Weldon, and I was a journalist at the Western Daily Press, which is a sister paper of the Bristol Evening Post, is owned by the same Northcliffe group. And I'm here because I'm devastated to hear the news that a city the size of Bristol is going to lose its Saturday edition, and that so many jobs are going. When you look at how many people were employed by the Post even just 6 years ago, and how many will be employed after these cuts, it is devastating for Bristol. We are living in tough times, but I think you have to look at how much money is still being made in the newspaper business. Regional news, yes, we're in very serious times, and people have to change their business structure, but they're not going to win by cutting journalists. What kind of service are they going to be able to offer? Even fewer people will be interested in reading the paper if they're not able to hold people like the local council, local officials to account.
His family fortune is £730 million, and yet he makes his journalists redundant. Let's say no to this fat cat. Say no to both her Rothermere. Come out here and join us.
£730 million personal fortune, but he still has to sack journalists, Tim.
Yes, I mean, I would say the commentary there, the commenter said that, you know, the Evening Post was holding needed to hold the council to account. It is the opposition within the council that holds the administration to account, not the Evening Post directly. And I think you know, we need to be aware of that.
But doesn't it? I mean, it informs the public who then vote in an opposition.
Well, it'll be their perspective on things, clearly, which is fine. I mean, you know, newspapers do publish stories all the time with their perspective. But I think, yeah, I had no idea there was so much money involved in newspapers. I thought they were on much harder times, but I'm not sure that their profits are relevant to the actual, you know, whatever their business model might be. I don't know,
but I mean, they made this is the most recently filed accounts for Bristol News and Media, which is the Evening Post and Western Daily Press, operating profit of £1.5 million, the most recent one up to the end of last year. But so, I mean, the question really is, that profit, should it be reinvested into the paper?
Does it beg the question,
or should it go to the shareholders?
Well, it's not for me to decide, because I'm not a shareholder and I'm not not in a position. But I would say, you know, if you're taking it at face value, I can see where you're coming from. I'm sure people would see where you're coming from in terms of money, but it may not be as simple as that. And as I say, I'm not a shareholder and I'm not.
Yeah, I think it's interesting you say that, because we were talking about Temple Meads earlier. We were talking about the buses, and now we're talking about the Evening Post. And, you know, this is the kind of thing that Liberals do say, it's private property, and what can I do? I'm a socialist, and actually I think that Temple Meads Station ought to be owned by either the Bristol City Council or the or National Rail. I think the local buses were much better managed when they were run by local authorities. And if the, you know, if the Evening Post, if we want the Evening Post, we might have to decide that we want to pay for it, or make Northcliffe pay for it. Because of course the business model is we're going to squeeze as much out of these people as possible and give as little back as we can. And of course she's quite right, the journalist. Eventually people are not going to read something which is just a load of adverts. And in fact, the other problem that we've got in journalism is that certainly at national level, advertising revenues are going down. We lost the Clevedon Mercury the other day. This is part of the general problem of the recession, but not for this newspaper.
Now, one of the first untruths you will read when you open a copy of the new Post is the paper all Bristol called for and helped to create, because the opposite is actually the case. The paper we see today is owned by Northcliffe, which is part of Lord Rothermere's Daily Mail empire. The Bristol Evening Post was set up in 1932 by public subscription in an appeal led by the Bishop of Malmesbury. It was formed as an independent Bristol-owned paper precisely to compete with the Northcliffe paper of its day, the Evening World, which it eventually outsold. So let's not forget also that Rothermere supported the Nazis in the 1930s, along with many of our German ancestry royalty, such as Edward VIII, who had changed his name from Saxe-Coburg-Gotha to Windsor during the First World War. Anyway, shares in the original 1932 Bristol Evening Post were gradually bought up by Lord Rothermere's son in the 1970s, and by the 80s he began to demand places on the board and took the Bristol Evening Post back under Rothermere control. But that was only after the Bristol owners and chairman Walter Hawkins had died. Well, Walter's wife is still alive and lives up in Alverston on the way to Thornbury, and I spoke to her recently about her husband Walter and how the character of the Bristol Evening Post has changed since it was retaken over in the 80s by Rothermere's Northcliffe newspapers.
The Evening World and the Evening Post were competitive, and there came a time when there wasn't really room in Bristol for two evening newspapers. So there was always this sort of enmity between them. They sold about the same at one point, and then the Evening Post sold a few more. But the Evening World was not owned by anybody in Bristol. It was owned by Rothermere's. This Rothermere was the first Northcliffe newspaper man, and he was Walter's contemporary. It seemed sort of, you know, that they couldn't really get on together. There just wasn't any business for both of them. The Evening World tried sort of funny tricks, because they said at one time that they were saying that their circulation was twice that of the Evening Post, but some spy discovered that they were putting half their sort of printing down in a place down in Somerset and burning it. Husband. His father was director of the Evening Post, chairman and director. Herbert Hawkins, his grandfather was Walter Hawkins the First. He founded the Bristol Post Boy in Bristol, and then which was inherited by Herbert Hawkins, who then brought up his family in Bristol, in Redland, and Walter was the one son, and then got a job in the Evening Post, and his father said, you can learn to be a newspaper man. It's in a very old building and rather creaky. He regarded his staff, it's more like his, not his servants, his family. And I remember the staff were very important in his life to him, and he treated them like his brothers. The staff knew that if they went upstairs, they could knock on the door and he'd always talk to them about anything. And they'd never had this with anyone else before, and with none of the other directors, really. And that was how he was, and he'd always talk to anybody. No appointments, anything. And I remember once in Silver Street, there was a flood from some or other pipe or other, that something had gone wrong during the night, and the whole of the printing room, which was down in the cellar, they cast the metal down there to make the plates to print from. And somebody came up and said, one of the foundry people, he went up and he said, "Who's that funny man who is down there in Wellington boots sweeping out the water?" And so this fellow said, "Well, that's the managing director." He was managing director then. And he was that sort of person, you know, hands-on, very much keen. And he got this from his father, really. I mean, his father and his grandfather were all in newspapers, you see. They passed the thing on. The old Lord Rothermere said he would buy enough shares in the Evening Post, but he had a gentleman's agreement that he would never buy more, the one below or whatever it was, you know. But of course, eventually, because they had so many shares, one of the directors of Associated Newspapers, which was Rothermere's firm, Walter was older then and had retired, and so had Lord Rothermere died, and then his son took over, and he was then Lord Rothermere, you see. But he insisted, because they had so many shares, that one of the Daily Mail would sit on the board of the Evening Post, and they didn't think this was very harmful, you know, because they always had a very good friendship with them. And so that's what happened. Well, then as the years went on and Walter retired, they had another one. They had two people on the Evening Post, and they did have one try at taking over. They had all these sort of Bristol people came to the AGM and refused. When it came for the takeover, there were actually some people, wives came, whose husbands had died, and had left them the shares in the Evening Post, and they still had them. An awful lot of people came and said that, you know, they'd got these 100 shares at the time. The takeover was by the Rothermere, by the Daily Mail. It was after Walter died, you know, in the 1980s.
That was Joan Hawkins there, who lives up in Alverston on the way up to Thornbury, talking about her husband Walter Hawkins, who was, I think, quite possibly the last Bristol managing director of the Bristol Evening Post, before, that is, whilst it was still the paper all Bristol called for and helped to create, and not bought up by the Northcliffe Empire again. Tim, I mean, isn't this inevitable, all of this, really, because the internet's taking over and people are getting the news that way?
Yeah, I mean, 'cause I was coming, that was quite a delightful story, actually, we were listening to there, kind of, you know, historical reminiscing. Yeah, I mean, the internet is a factor, and we were just saying in the break that, you know, the problem with the internet is it's not turned out to be as profitable for companies as they thought, and, you know, circulations are in decline. And it's survival, isn't it? You know, we're going to end up with fewer and fewer players, and they're going to be wanting to make profit out of a small market. And that's the problem, isn't it? It's an ever-decreasing circle of market share.
Okay, now, Prime Minister's Questions is back this week after the Easter break. The House of Commons are sitting again, and one of the most interesting people who popped their head up at Prime Minister's Questions was the new MP, George Galloway.
Mr. George Galloway. As I was saying, Mr. Speaker, there is an ironclad consensus across the three front benches about what they now call a mission, but given the amount of blood on the ground and the rapidly deteriorating military situation, most of us call a war in Afghanistan. In the wake of Mrs. Gillard's decision to accelerate the withdrawal of Australian forces from that war, and in the wake of the Bradford West by-election, will the Prime Minister reconsider his current planning on our withdrawal from this bloody maw of Afghanistan?
Well, first of all, let me congratulate the Honourable Gentleman on his stunning by-election victory and his return to this House of Commons. And I know he always speaks with great power and great force. But on this issue, I have to say I profoundly disagree with him. Our troops are in Afghanistan, not fighting a war against Islam, but at the invitation of an Islamic government and under a UN resolution to try and help that country to have a peaceful, prosperous and stable future. And he knows the dangers in the past of walking away from Afghanistan and leaving that country to become the terrorist supporting haven that it did under the Taliban. We mustn't make that mistake again, and I would urge him not to play to the gallery on this issue, but to speak up for the work our forces are doing to make Afghanistan a safer country.
Tim, what do you make of George Galloway there?
Well, George Galloway, yes, I like George, I must say. I used to listen to his show on 5 Live before he's just become an MP again.
It was on TalkSport, which is on medium wave. And actually, right, he's been, all of the talk, other than sport, on TalkSport has been got rid of about 3-4 weeks before the by-election. But anyhow.
Yes, that's right. I mean, he doesn't change his approach to politics, from what I've heard. He's very open and but I disagree with his politics essentially.
What about this whole business of Afghanistan? He's saying it's not really a mission, it is a war, it's a failure, we should just do what the Australians are doing and just slowly pull out.
Well, the government stated its position, but you know, if you do that, you could be opening yourself up to, you know, it's been said, you could be opening yourself up to the problem of, you know, of leaving a situation half undone. Yes, I wouldn't like to say too much about it. It's not an area of expertise for me, but I do understand there are different points of view. I would say that much. I do understand that.
Yeah, well, I think talking to army contacts that I have, they realise that it's hopeless at every level.
But doesn't it mean, surely, if you've got a purpose of being there, no, you should carry on?
Well, Karzai, let's remember who Karzai is. He packed the ballot boxes. So this guy who's our ally, who has actually already said he wants everybody in their bases and back home as soon as, although the British and the Americans don't want to listen to him, he didn't win that election. It was a fraudulent election, far more fraudulent than the elections in Iran, for example. So the guy's got no credibility whatsoever. His brother, Wali Karzai, who was assassinated by the Taliban about a year ago, was named by the DEA as the top drug dealer in Afghanistan, even though he's on the CIA payroll. And it goes back to what I was saying earlier about the 1980s. We've been sticking our finger into Afghanistan for over 30 or 40 years. The amount of British money that's been spent on killing Afghans is obscene. And in actual fact, people in the Muslim world are fed up with our cant and hypocrisy about all of this. People in Pakistan are being murdered by drones which are being flown from Afghanistan. And ultimately, why they're in Afghanistan is because they want to threaten the Chinese and they want to build a pipeline through Helmand Province. But they can't do that because they can't control Helmand Province. This is the reality of the situation. This is power politics of the 19th century kind with 21st century weapons. The British people have already seen through it. The political class are still coming out with the rubbish. But it doesn't matter what they say. Doesn't matter what they say, the Taliban IEDs now are absolutely undetectable, and they've realised that. That's game over. You're defeated.
Last weekend, there was a massive attack by the insurgents and the Taliban on the capital, Kabul, Martin, that took almost 18 hours to quell, one of the biggest ever attacks, and most audacious and well-coordinated, apparently. There were three other eastern provinces, simultaneous attacks as well, so it doesn't look as if it's over yet.
Well, it's not going to be over. If we withdraw, the fighting will continue because we basically set it up to continue as we set it up in the 1980s. The Najibullah government, which was supported by the Russians, managed to survive for 3 years after the Russians had pulled out because it did have some popular support. Karzai hasn't got any. But of course, what we've done is we've made the place a misery for years. It's a disgrace. It's a shame on this country's honour. And the soldiers who are dying out there, I've got every sympathy for them. But don't forget, your American allies, while you're being blown up by Taliban IEDs, are rampaging around drunk, raping and murdering. Now, at some point, you've got to draw the line under it and cut your losses. That moment has come. The Australians have realised it.
Tim, this has been going on for a long time, this Afghanistan thing, but I'm going to give you the final word on it.
Okay. Well, I mean, you know, support the armed forces in their quest. I mean, I've actually served in the Royal Signal, so I've had some experience with the military, and that is my position, I think, that, you know, no matter what happens, we need to support the guys who are doing the job on the ground. They've been tasked, they've performed extraordinarily well. I think we can all see that, and we hear it every day. Yes, let's, you know, when they come home, we will celebrate. I think that's all you can say, and they will have done a good job, I've no doubt.
So that was Prime Minister's Questions to George Gallery, stirring things up, as he always does. Now, back to Prime Minister's Questions, and this time, let's have a listen to one of the exchanges between Ed Miliband, the Labour leader, and David Cameron.
Mr. Speaker, in case he's very excited today, Mr. Speaker, in case he's forgotten, it's Prime Minister's Questions. The clue's in the name. I ask the questions, and he's supposed to answer them. No answer on pensioners. No answer on families. What about charities? The Prime Minister's big idea was the big society. But since the budget, I don't know why he's taking advice from the part-time Chancellor sitting next to him, Mr. I wonder which job he's doing today, Mr. Speaker. But since the budget, the government has managed to insult people who give to charity, and he's insulted the charities themselves by implying they're bogus. Now, the Prime Minister claimed he worked on the budget line by line. Did he know when he signed off the budget that it represented a hit of as much as £500 million on Britain's charities.
These figures are completely wrong, but let me tell the right honourable gentleman, first of all, absolutely no defence of Ken Livingstone, not a word. And what this is all about is making sure that the richest people in our country do pay their taxes. Now, last year, there were over 300 people earning over £1 million who paid a rate of tax of 10%. I don't think that's good enough. And we've got a Labour candidate for Mayor of London who's paying less tax on his earnings than the person who cleans his office. I think that's disgraceful. Why won't he condemn it?
Well, the hoo-ha is back again. Martin, I know you're not a big fan of Prime Minister's questions, but it did seem there that David Cameron simply wasn't answering the questions. I mean, what is the point of having a Prime Minister's questions when he's just saying, well, you've got your figures wrong, and then he goes on and starts asking questions of the leader of the opposition?
Well, that's why I don't like Prime Minister's questions. You put your finger on it. Basically, people say what they want to say. It demeans politics. I used to live in Poland, and I worked in the Polish Parliament with my colleagues there, and it's like watching paint dry. But they're getting on with the job. That's not getting on with the job, it's a joke.
Isn't it Speaker's job to make sure that the questions are actually answered rather than just avoided?
Ultimately, in Britain, what you've got is the Prime Minister's got all power. So this is the only time of the week when he gets baited. But in the Polish Parliament, where they're making coalitions all the time, because they've got PR, there's an awful lot of horse trading going on, which is carried out in a very different tone of voice from that, I can tell you.
Yes, I mean, a certain amount of pantomime goes on, doesn't it, in the parliamentary debate of Prime Minister's questions. I suspect there's a good deal going on behind the scenes, as often happens in these things. With regard to the charitable, I think the big argument is over the actual taxing of charitable donations. Correct me if I think
no,
it
that's
is.
Right, yeah.
Yes, I mean, that does seem to be something you sort of play with at your peril, from what I've heard. I mean, Tony Blair was on television. I mean, we haven't seen him for a crop up for a while. And he, you know, and Tony Blair was obviously saying that, you know, I wouldn't go down this road. So he's had some experience of government, he was saying, in this, you know, particular area. And I think it's always risky when you start talking about taxing people on charitable donations. I mean, you know,
but it's not good for the big society. That's the point Ed Miliband's making.
It's
there.
Not
he's
good
saying,
for charities, actually.
He's saying if you're going to rely on a big society, charities need to be helped, not taxed.
I would say no more than I've said. I think it's, you know, if you're going to tax charitable donations, think about it before you do it, I think is the question.
I think this whole question of whether charities are bogus or not is a serious one. I used to work in the former Soviet Union, and the mafia used to use charities to avoid tax all the time. But that's for the charity commissioners, isn't it? If charities are bogus, like Werity and Fox's little charity, Atlantic Bridge, which was said, this isn't a charity, this is just a private...
This is the former Defence Secretary.
Indeed.
What on earth was that charity doing there, Martin? Can you just expand on that a bit?
The charity commissioners moved in on it and said, this isn't a proper charity. You know, because charities, they spent most of their money on freebies and trips and so on. Now, charities can be campaigning, like Oxfam. I remember Oxfam in the 80s. They had a lot of grief because they wanted to campaign against apartheid in South Africa. But the charity commissioners ultimately said that's within your charitable brief to do that. But they also had to set up Oxfam campaigns had to be separate from Oxfam, Oxfam proper and so on. This is for the charity commissioners. Just saying to people who are giving charitable donations, if it's more than 500,000, then you've got to pay tax on it, is a kick in the teeth for legitimate charities that are trying to do things. And of course, it's not joined up government, is it? On the one hand, we're going to have charities taking over everything, and on the other hand, we're not going to give them any money. Sounds like virtually the rest of the economic policy, frankly.
Well, I see you nodding there, Tim. Right, on to the stand up and be counted. George Ferguson kickstarts the Bristol Mayor debate. Well, the Bristol Mayor debate has been going on for a little bit longer than that. But architect George Ferguson has started the debate over an elected mayor for Bristol by becoming the first candidate to throw his hat into the ring for the post. The former high sheriff who founded the tobacco factory in Southville and the canteen on Stokes Croft wants the issue to become a major talking point before for a referendum on May the 3rd. Well, there's only about 2 weeks to go on this one, Tim Lehman, Lib Dem councillor. So what's your thoughts on the whole
thing? Well, I'm actually not in favour. And there's several reasons. I mean, the cost is one. I mean, you know, they won't have any additional powers. There's no Greater Bristol involved, so you're not going to be able to influence necessarily outside the city. And I think the city has its own identity. It has a clear history. It doesn't need a bolt-on personality who's going to, you know, what's going to happen to councillors. I mean, we represent our wards, and it could upset democracy. You could get some kind of dictatorship out of it, almost, representing specific interests. I think it's a worry, and I think it's not going to do the city a power of good. I don't see that a personality is what we need. We have a leader, we have a cabinet, we have a party system. It works perfectly well, and I mean, to pay up to £1 million to have someone, you know, to do a lot of publicity and other things, I don't think is really going to work.
So the argument is, it's common sense. If one person is in charge, then they can actually get things done. Well, they see the current system as too bureaucratic.
No, you're putting all the in a way, you're filtering all the decision making and policy making and through one person. And, you know, they will have, what will they do? Will they be part-time? Will they be a business person? You know, I've had people come to me and say, oh, yes, the council should be run as a business. No, it should not. Entirely. I mean, the council already, employs contractors and private contractors, but there are elements of the service of the council that have to be relied upon. It's a public service. It's funded through taxpayers.
But so you don't agree at all with this argument that actually the council at the moment is too bureaucratic?
Oh, well, there may well be some argument about bureaucracy. There always is. You know, it's too bureaucratic. There's too many people, you know, involved. Yes, there's bound to be some bureaucracy in all local government. There has to be. I'm not sure I can comment that there's too much in there. I think that's controversial. So I'll leave it at that, if I may.
Well, I agree with all of that. And the other thing that strikes me is that we've got no local elections in Bristol this May. And our activists won't be out knocking on doors, and nor will yours.
This is very true.
And it's very likely that we're going to get a turnout, I guess, in the region of around 20%. And on the back of that, we could then get, say, 11% who vote for an elected mayor, mostly in Clifton, I bet you. And then we will end up with an elected mayor, whether we like it or not. And as I said at the debate last Friday about this on College Green, perhaps the No campaign should just call for a boycott. Because, of course, when we were doing the referendum in Ireland, in Scotland and in Wales, you had to get 50% plus one. In fact, 55% in Scotland. So the devolution referendum failed in 1979 because they won it, but they didn't win it by enough. But this is just going to be foisted on us by central government, and we're going to be told we're being empowered. It's management.
The other thing which I'm a bit bothered about is the fact that we've got this article all about George Ferguson launching his campaign, but nowhere in there anywhere does it mention that he's one of the Society of Merchant Venturers, which is obviously a very big business.
I think it's very important as to who you get and what direction of travel they want to go in and what their stall will be. You know, to run a city this size, it takes an awful lot of hard work from an awful lot of people. And I think, you know, one person coming up and saying, you know, I'm going to do it, and in my own image is probably not the answer.
Okay, that's you just heard there, Tim Leeman, Lib Dem councillor for King's Weston. After the news, it started this week, but why does it take a foreign TV channel to give Julian Assange his own talk show? BCFM.org.uk. BCFMU.